Welcome to Momentum Magnet, a podcast to inspire your growth. I'm Karen Morales, and your host in helping you find ways to make positive changes for your business, health, relationships, and life. We always have a path to a happier ending, so let's get started today. Hi, and welcome to Momentum Magnet. We're here every Friday talking to unique thought leaders about issues that can help you drive your life and business forward. Today, we're going to talk a little about storytelling and speaking. I've found over the course of my career that the more authentic you are with a message, the more you can connect with an audience, the more resonant your advice becomes. I mean, when you think back in your life and you think of all the times you've heard great information, more often than not, it was packaged in the form of a story. I think it's hard sometimes to start there. When you're thinking about being a speaker, often you're nervous about standing in front of an audience and revealing anything that feels too personal. But in actuality, the best speakers do just that. So today, when we talk about launching your speaking career, I've brought an amazing guest, Alexia Vernon. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you.
That is wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about your road to becoming a speaker and your really interesting backstory?
Absolutely. And as you know, but people who are listening might not, I love telling my story for a couple of reasons. Number one, I'm not somebody who came naturally to being a public speaker and to possessing speaking confidence. And I think that that's really important for people who are wanting to speak to hear. And second, I am and always will be an introvert. And I like to make it possible for those who might similarly be introverted to recognize that speaking is not something that only works for those who get fed by being in front of large groups of people. So the reason I preface by saying all of this is if you were to time travel back to when I was growing up and tell me that I was going to be a public speaker, I would laugh because the very first time I gave a speech in front of an audience, I was in probably third grade. It went horribly wrong. People laughed at me. I cried and it started a really uncomfortable on again, off again relationship with my own voice because when I would find myself in a situation where there were eyes on me, I would oftentimes go back into that story of this is going to go wrong. People might laugh at me. I might cry. I'm going to walk away feeling diminished. And then fast forward to 19 years old, I wound up entering the Miss Junior America competition. I was incredibly motivated to do just about anything for scholarship money, including speak publicly. And I wound up winning the competition, and that somewhat accidentally thrust me onto the speaking circuit for the rest of my college years. But public speaking discomfort doesn't go away just because you have one win. It took me almost another decade to learn how to be able to play nicely with the sensation I was experiencing when I was visible. And once I wound up starting my own business after working in the nonprofit social justice and training spheres early in my career, once I started to master getting comfortable and being able to move people to take action on my ideas for myself, that's when I knew I wanted to pivot my young consulting business to show other business leaders and coaches and consultants and change makers how to be able to do the same thing for themselves.
It's so interesting that you describe yourself as a natural introvert, because I think a lot of us have these stories or these definitions of who we are as people. But the most important part in that story and in your transformation to become someone who is now, you know, an effective speaker would be that moment of pressure, that moment of change, and that desire to get that scholarship money was bigger than your fear of being on stage. And I think that's something that, you know, people don't often realize, that there's usually a point of pressure that makes us change. And you can easily overcome a deep fear if your desire on the other side is bigger than the fear itself.
100%. And that's something I always tell my clients and my audience members as well, is that in those moments where you feel deeply uncomfortable, a piece of it is certainly learning how to be in your body and not try to escape that discomfort. And one of the biggest things that's going to enable you to be able to do that is remembering that your why has to be greater than your fear.
Absolutely. And I think so many times, or I've at least learned myself as I came to terms with talking more about, you know, my physical challenges and an illness I deal with, I was so nervous about other people's reaction. But a lot of times the nervousness that we have is really fabricated in our own minds. And when you actually say these statements out loud, or you share your story, your deepest fear, you're so surprised that the reaction that you've created is exactly the opposite in true life. Did you have a similar moment when you were on that stage and you were doing your piece for your pageant and you realized, wow, like speaking in front of people actually feels good and it's not the challenge that I thought it was?
Yes, that was for sure one of the first moments I felt, not only on message, because I went to a great school for middle school and high school and all girls school, and I had to speak a lot. And so I had learned if I write everything out and I cling to my notes like a baby orangutan might cling to its mother, like I can get through as long as I don't have to make eye contact. But Miss Junior America was definitely the first time I had no notes. I had nothing other than a microphone in front of me, between me and a rather large audience. But yet I also wasn't doing what I'd frequently do, which was ask myself, Lex, do you sound smart enough? Are you funny enough right now? Do you seem credible enough? Instead, I focused 100% on the subject I was talking about, which was preventing sexual assault on college campuses. And that was huge for
that
me.
That was your first speech topic. So you didn't just go in with an easy lob. You didn't.
No, I mean, I'm at this pageant. I didn't choose world hunger or puppies.
You sure didn't. You went straight to sexual assault. So how did you get your moxie up? How did you get enough nerve to tackle that as your first public speaking engagement?
Great question. I am a sexual abuse survivor. I was molested growing up by a family member, and it was also one of the first things I ever spoke up about in my family. Now, not to sidebar too much, but that initial act of what I would call moxie did not, as listeners know, start a chain reaction of me consistently speaking up. It actually had, in some ways, the opposite effect, because there were some people in my family who were ready for that revelation and did what you hope an adult would do if they heard that a young person was being abused. But because it was happening in my family, there were other people who were absolutely not ready for that revelation coming out of the mouth of a four-year-old and did what most sensible adults would hope never to do. But unfortunately, what we know happens a lot, they tried to convince me I'd made a mistake, I got the wrong person. Others were considerably more ugly and suggested I was doing it for attention. And so the message that I'd archived for a lot of years is that when I speak, people do listen, but I may not want that responsibility. And when I had the opportunity at Miss Junior America to think about a platform and something I was passionate about, even though I was a freshman on my college campus at the time, I was immediately involved in preventing sexual assault on campus as a sexual assault peer educator, because it just felt like if I don't use my voice to do something with my experience, like it's all in vain. And so when I was speaking on that stage, all I cared about was trying to get more people to want to be active on their campuses to help prevent the cycle of sexual assault that was happening on so many campuses. And this is a core lesson that I teach, which is when we are 100% focused on connecting with people and moving them to take action on an idea, it actually gets rid of so much of the self-defeating self-talk, because there's no room for us to think about ourselves if we're focused on our audience.
Because the idea is big enough. And I think that's one of the reasons people sometimes fail in achieving their goals. They try to sidestep or tiptoe their way to their end result, taking tiny, tiny steps forward. And I see some of the best leaders doing exactly what you did. They just rip off the Band-Aid and they go after what they want and what they care about. So they didn't, you didn't step up to the microphone and talk about, you know, living in a large family. You stepped up to the microphone and mic dropped your biggest core truth and something that resonated in the heart of your being. And because of that, you overcame the fear in one fell swoop because you went there.
Yes. Now, of course, it took years to recognize that's what made that presentation so successful. Yep. It definitely helped that the room was really dark and there were a lot of faces I couldn't see. And I share that because what I did that I now know was wrong was that when I would get in front of audiences after that, that frequently when I was a college student talking to boys and girls clubs and high school students and so forth, like it was much more intimate because I could see them, is that then I started to hustle for other people's approval and be liked. And I toned down my messages and I didn't say a whole lot of anything that had substance. And that was when I started to experience people not resonating with me, that there are times, many times, where there are people who do not like what it is that we have to say. And if we're not really speaking truths that shake some people up, the people who actually need to hear from us don't get that opportunity. And so while we might be mediocre to everybody and fine, I would much rather have those people who go so far as to cancel me so that I can also have those people whose lives are rocked by me.
Yeah, I understand that so well. And we were speaking to a suicide prevention activist recently on a show, and Frank was saying the same thing. He said he has never had a time where he's been in front of an audience and talked about suicide where somebody hasn't stopped him or followed up with him and said, "I'm you." Mm-hmm. And he said, that is the person in every speech that I'm talking to. Yes. And I think for you, you know, in that moment, the other survivor of sexual abuse is the person you're talking to. You know, in my speeches, I try to connect with a person who has insane levels of adversity and wants to crack through that barrier regardless of any headwind. And if I've reached that one person, then I've done my job. So I think that's a great way to set up a frame for your speaking career. You don't have to look at that audience and look at thousands of people and worry about landing with all of them.
Because you never will.
You never will, right? Look at it as one person. And I know that Brené Brown talks about that, of how she got through her first TED Talk. She pictured like the one face in the audience that she thought was going to be receptive, and she spoke to that human.
It's such a great reminder that when we focus in on speaking to individual people rather than thinking about an anonymous audience of lots of people, it also makes us more compelling because we're more able to speak to the conversation that's going on in the heads and in the hearts of those people in that audience, which makes each person feel like we're speaking directly to them rather than just driving home a message through people.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So it sounds like you give a really basic tip, right? If you want to get that over that moxie and you want to have that impetus to move forward, you have to find your voice and you have to find your why. And you have to find that topic that matters to you so personally that you feel compelled to share it. And then when you stand up to give your message, you navigate that discomfort by speaking towards the human that needs to receive that message, somebody who personifies the message that you're actually delivering. Mm-hmm. Now, how much is your speaking career? Because you've done a lot, right? Not only did you start out in this pageant speaking about a really weighty topic of sexual abuse, but you've also had a health crisis. And can you talk a little bit about how your voice and your message has evolved since that early time?
You bet. And it's funny because I want to say which one, because there's been several.
I know.
I think I know which one you're referring to, but I'm going to take a step back and then I promise I'll get to that one.
All right. That's fine.
That when it felt like my business and my confidence were at the very best place they'd been, I was over that six-figure hurdle, which had been elusive for so long. I was pregnant and couldn't have been more thrilled that my husband and I were bringing in a little girl into the world. And I wasn't having to work that much. I was working maybe 20 to 25 hours a week. And my business was perfect. It was a mix of my own keynote speaking, working with organizations on issues of women's leadership, but also creating high-packed communicators within their companies. And then me starting to self-produce and lead some of my own women's leadership programs. And then I had my daughter, and within 3 weeks' time, found myself fully enmeshed in postpartum depression and questioning, how am I somebody who shows people in the world how to find and activate and more fully express their voices in the world when this natural rite of passage as a woman has so completely disconnected me from my own? And I share that not only because I know so many, I don't even want to say women, so many men have been impacted as well by postpartum depression through their partners, but because we often think that when we've mastered a lesson, that then we go on cruise control. And my experience has been quite the opposite, that the work we're called to do is often work we have to revisit in new ways in our lives again and again and again. And so while my daughter just turned 7, so this was about 7 years ago, similarly, I've been in like a pretty good flow. I'm not going to lie that certainly COVID disrupted some things as somebody who speaks live and would train other people to speak live. But I was fortunately able to pivot a lot within approximately 120 days to be able to figure out how to stay relevant, how to keep cash flow coming in. But then in September of 2020, I got the diagnosis of thyroid cancer really unexpectedly, because I'd been down the path of having thyroid ultrasound and biopsy before, and it had come back benign. And I was believing those results that there was a less than 1 to 3% chance that I would ever be diagnosed with thyroid cancer. But you know, this particular diagnosis, I have to say, felt different than anything else that had led up in my life, because my first thought was not, oh, darn, I want to stay profanity free, but let's just say that there was some profanity you know, that could have been used in that situation, but rather it was, oh, this is interesting. Like I really felt that sense of really a tumor basically by my throat. Like this is almost comical. Like clearly there is growth for me here. Now I don't want to suggest that that's going to be every person's response to a big health diagnosis. I just want to be really honest that that was mine. And I'll just pause there to see where you want to go with this, Karen.
I mean, it's a lot, right? So we even skipped over the intermediary, and I wouldn't even say intermediary part of your career, and we sort of got to the end. So before we dive into your voice today, let's take 2 steps back. There's so much here, it's hard to know where to go, but after your journey into finding your voice through the platform of, you know, your early scholarship days and wanting to be able to provide for your college education, you did, you know, work and found a consulting agency, and you even worked at high levels of the government, you know, being branded a Moxie Maven by Obama's White House Office of Public Engagement. So you do have a professional voice and an experience. So when you were in the years before 2020, where were you going with your speaking engagements and how had your brand evolved?
Yes. So when I started out as a consultant, we're going back to 2007, 2008, I want to be really honest that it was messy, because I think a lot of people leave one version of professional success, hang out a shingle, and then think it's going to be rainbows and cupcakes. And for some it is, but for me, it definitely wasn't. I was allowing myself to be defined by whatever opportunities came my way. And I was pretty fortunate that even at a time of economic downturn, I had a lot of speaking and consulting opportunities come my way, but I was constantly pivoting who I was and what I was doing. So at one moment I might be talking about social justice issues. Then I might be talking about onboarding millennials in the workplace. Then I might be talking about future-proofing your career, which meant that nobody really knew how to think of me. And then I had the opportunity to be the closing keynote speaker at a prestigious social enterprise conference. And I got to the event a little bit early in time for the participants to participate in a pitch fest, which means that they had a couple of minutes to present their big idea for how to harness entrepreneurial solutions to solve a big social, economic, or environmental problem. And the pitches were really good. They were bold and well-researched and full of heart. It was the participants who got to vote on the finalists, meaning it wasn't the judges, rather it was approximately 120-somethings, and probably 50% of them were male, 50% of them were female. And I'm sharing those details with you so that you can appreciate why I was so stunned when the finalists' names were announced, because every single one of them was a man. Not one woman's voice was picked. And so I knew that in a few hours' time, I needed to give this inspirational closing keynote at this event, but I felt like there was a colony of butterfly wings just flapping, a colony of butterflies flapping their wings so vigorously inside of me. And so I started to ask whoever would speak to me, like, what just happened? Where are the voices of young women here? And what I heard both from the men and the women was sobering, but actually not that surprising, because they all said that they picked based on who they saw as the most confident speaker. This was a pitch fest, so they looked for people who took up a lot of space, who had volume, and that skewed more heavily male. But what was so fascinating is that when I asked who were the speakers that you felt most connected to, whose ideas you would want to fund and champion, both the men and women gave a lot of names of women, but they said they didn't pick them as the finalists because some of them had tells that they were uncomfortable. They might say, you know, I still need to get another degree or get some more experience before I'm ready to accept funding. Many of them told stories, but they were very quiet, and that wasn't seen as, quote, confident pitching. And the reason I'm taking the time to tell this story is that was the moment that a huge light bulb went off for me about how I had been ping-ponging between a masculine and feminine model of delivery, trying to get it right for everybody rather than being authentically me. But also, it was like in that moment, I suddenly understood how to correct everything that was a little bit wonky, how to stop hustling for other people's approval, how to stop hiding behind slide decks and other people's research, and do what was inherently my speaking style, which was to tell stories, ask questions, slow down my rate of delivery and my volume. And that was when I got really clear that that's where I wanted to grow my coaching and consulting business, doing that for individuals, doing that for organizations, and with a particular lens on what are some of the institutional barriers that are preventing women from being able to speak this way and move up into increasingly responsible leadership positions.
So allow women to really espouse the traditionally feminine way of bringing a message to life and not feel that they have to adopt all of the quote unquote, maybe confident and more bold, loud or fast styles of a more masculine leaning speaker. Is that how you would define it?
Yes, with a slight caveat that the best speakers, irrespective of gender, have a mix of feminine and masculine attributes. And yet I have found that for men, when they tell a story and they slow down, it's like people immediately respond like, that's so powerful. The way we see that is credible. But for women, there are some true institutional barriers there where when a woman tells a story, if there's any tell that she's uncomfortable, like that immediately chips away at other people's perceptions of her confidence. So a lot of the work that I do is absolutely with Well, at this point, I work a lot with men and with women so that they both have a truly authentic speaking style that moves people to take action. But particularly with women, not denying the barriers that might be there within their organizations. And like one of my favorite things to do is to work with companies to create more corporate gender responsibility so that the whole culture shifts to make space for what we deem as more feminine ways of communicating and leading, but helping individual women also be able to step into more executive presence.
I think you've really hit the nail on the head. I mean, I truly believe that the best speakers do have a yin and a yang of the feminine and the masculine energy. I mean, having sat through many of Tony Robbins' seminars, I think he's a perfect example on the masculine side of someone who is able to be confident and decisive and give you those pillars of action steps, and at the same time tell a very emotional, evocative story in a beautiful way. In my own experience, I had an example that happened, I think it was last year or the year before, where I was invited to speak at an event for women who had survived divorce, and I was a keynote speaker. And I gave them my bio that was a blend of the feminine and the masculine, right? It had a lot of the challenges that I went through in starting a business and having, health crisis and, children in crisis and financial challenges, and also was declarative about the financial success that my company had had quantified. And I was told that it was not acceptable because the confidence in giving a number was too much for the audience. And I pushed back and I said, I don't agree. Respectfully, if you want me to speak, this is my story. And I think more women have to see the potential. They will hear the soft side of my story. I will probably tear up when I talk about some of the hard moments, but I'm giving them a stance because it's about possibility. And that's my message, is setting the bar higher with substantiated data to back it up. And I stuck to my guns. We had a lot of words back and forth, and I said, take it or leave it. Like, I come as the bio that I'm giving you, or I come not at all. And when I spoke at the event, it was the perfect message and landed a standing ovation simply because it was the balance of the masculine and the feminine. And it works. But for women, it takes you out of your comfort zone sometimes to be able to have the confidence to deliver some of those facts or the brazen opinions that we aren't necessarily socialized to say.
There's so many times I wanted to interject as you were talking and say, yes, exclamation point. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think all I want to add there is that for so many women, and I definitely see this skewing more female than male, is that when we start to feel all that stuff, we are more apt to go into a narrative that problematizes it. I'm anxious. I'm fearful. This is more evidence. I'm never going to be able to get to the other side, or I'm never going to be confident enough. And I think men are better able to say, yeah, I'm feeling all of it, and like put a comma on it and move on. And that's another piece of preparing women for more high stakes opportunities, whether that's speaking on stage or negotiation, or simply upholding a boundary that's been trespassed, is recognizing that the sensation isn't the problem. It's the story we create that keeps us stuck, that is. And the way through all of that is that when we start to feel a lot in these moments, when we're on the cusp of doing something big or saying something big, is to actually express gratitude and to stay in our bodies, to slow down our breathing and be with it, because sensation is just sensation. If you think about those moments where like something amazing was about to happen, whether it was a wedding or in some cases a divorce, like we were probably feeling a lot. And that's normal. As humans, the more that we can stay in our bodies and remind ourselves that not only can we say hard things, but we can feel hard things, the more likely it is that we're going to be able to speak through it and stay on our path of making impact.
Yeah, I think that is the right approach and the right framework. And I know in that moment, I think the line back I said to this, you know, speakers bureau was, would you have called Bill Gates and said, hey, Bill, I need you to downplay your accomplishments to make the other men feel better? I said, that would never happen and he would never do it. So I say, no. And I'm interested, since you certainly have way more experience and training in the science of feminism, and you are a TEDx speaker on the topic, what is your current vision of the future of feminism? So I know you've been heavily quoted in the media way more than I have, you know, NBC, CBS, Wall Street Journal on this topic.
In many ways, the simplest description is that I see all social change, whether we're talking about feminism, racism, any other ism, as being a mix of how do we elevate marginalized voices? So what is the self-improvement piece that's there? But that has to be integrated with the social justice piece of looking at what are the systemic blocks that have to be addressed. But I think so often we want to go to one, it's all self-improvement, or we want to go to the other, it's all institutional. And it's being able to support individual women, people of color, those who are experiencing discrimination because of disabilities or chronic illnesses. But it's also like we can't take our eye off of what are the systems, whether it's within our own individual companies or in society at large, that are contributing.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. So for people that are listening and they have a voice inside of them, they have an issue that is near and dear to their heart, and they're trying to figure out either their path to make it a business, you know, increase their sales, or maybe expand into speaking. I have a question for you.
Yes.
So at the very beginning of your career, you mentioned that you weren't really sure what your niche was, right? You were out there being hired as a consultant for various tasks, and you were out there speaking on various subject areas. Today, your platform, Alexia Vernon, includes coaching, you have a book, you have speaking in media. How were you able to kind of find what your sharpened brand identity would be? And then how do you sort of balance your writing, your speaking, and your consulting across that theme? Does one play the lead horse, or do they all work together in aggregate as the sum of your brand, like your three product offerings, one might say?
I feel like I could write an entire book on this.
I know.
There's such good questions there. So let me unpack as succinctly as possible. In hindsight, because hindsight is always 20/20, I did a lot wrong. But what I ultimately did right, and it took me longer than it takes most of my clients if I'm working with them on this, is to think about, what is my thought leadership message? Like, how can I distill it down? In the TED world, we would call that an idea worth spreading. Right. But like, what is the core idea that I want to be known for? And then how do I make sure that everything
I create... Right there, so we can walk people through the process. So if I say, hey, Alexa, what's your idea worth spreading? How do you answer that?
Yep. So my idea worth spreading is actually very similar to what I just described to you a moment ago when you asked me the question about the future of feminism, that if we want to affect change in this world, we have to use an approach that both integrates individual people's vocal empowerment while looking at the systems that make it difficult and really reshape those systems so that everybody has access to being able to elevate and use their voice.
Yeah, give everybody a voice equally. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. And so once I know that, then I can look at, okay, is my signature talk one that forwards that idea? Is that signature talk moving people into individual or group programs that support that idea? I'm on the cusp of launching a certification program in my Step Into Your Moxie speaking process. So does that program show other coaches, consultants, HR, business leaders how to be able to lead that work for their people? But the minute I start to go off track, and I'm somebody who's multi-passionate, so that's not hard for me to do, that's where I get fused and I get exhausted because I feel like I'm going in too many different directions. But also that's the moment where usually I sabotage revenue because now people don't know how to think of me. And I see that with a lot of coaches and consultants that we want to do all the things. The problem is not the too many mediums, the writing, the speaking, the coaching, the consulting. It's pretty easy to transition for me. And I've seen this with a lot of my clients between, okay, I'm writing an article and now I'm preparing a talk or now I'm pitching a podcast. If there's coherence in the idea and in the message, because then it all feeds. But if I'm talking about, I'm trying to think of some disparate topics. If I'm talking about how to light it up on Clubhouse or on Instagram. Right. And now I'm talking about how to be a better parent. And now I'm, if I have all these different topics, that's where I get confused. That's where I stop having natural traction happen.
Yeah, your identity is truly your core message, not the channels you deliver them in.
Exactly. And there's lots of subtopics. I can sometimes talk about women. Sometimes I can talk about just high stakes conversations, but it's all a part of the same underlying bigger message.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So if somebody is listening and they said, okay, I hear you. I know what my ideal worth spreading is. I know how I could bring that to life in various channels, whether it's writing or consulting, training or speaking engagements. Why do you think speaking is one of the most impactful ways to start spreading that message?
Most people make decisions about what to do, what programs, services to invest in, who they want as a mentor when they have that personal connection to somebody. And whether you're speaking on a podcast, whether you're speaking on a traditional stage, or whether you're speaking in any other online format, it is the fastest way for people to feel that deep connection with you. And as a result, decide to make a purchasing decision for your product, for your service, for your support, whatever it is. And it also has a far, the barrier to entry, truthfully, since COVID has never been lower. There are so many opportunities to spread one's message. And so you don't have to have millions of social media followers or people on your list. You just have to have a really clear message, have the messaging to be able to pitch it, understand how that works to support your business so that your speaking is driving people towards being able to stay in touch and hopefully in a business relationship with you. And I find that it's those little pieces that aren't hard, but there's definitely important structures in place that most people are missing. And so for too many, that's why speaking hasn't been successful yet.
So we always love to leave our listeners with sort of our momentum tips for getting started. So I think this is a great place to base this question on for you. So with the switch in the speaking world because of COVID, what are three ways or places people could start spreading their message and getting booked in more speaking gigs?
Number one, start with the people you know. Most people are far more comfortable submitting an anonymous submission online, but let the people you are currently in relationship with know that you're wanting to speak. And if they have opportunities at the moment, most is online, that you'd love to be considered. It shocks me how many seasoned keynote speakers will still forget to update the people in their network if they develop a new topic, or forget to share a recent keynote that they gave with the people in their network. So that hands down is number one. For number two, get really clear on what is the number one topic and what's your viewpoint on it. So a lot of people make the mistake early on. They want to have five topics or even three topics. If you're not regularly speaking, develop one signature talk and begin by creating what is that title where people immediately get it. And then number three, for those who are now wanting to create that content, is make sure that you understand, or you're working with somebody if you don't, how to create a signature talk that connects to the head and the heart of the people who are listening, but moves them to take action in their own lives, but also positions them to want to work with you or stay in touch with you.
Yeah, that's great advice. So for the audience that's listening, and they're thinking, I've got my idea and I have been working on this speech and a platform, but I'm not really sure if it resonates. How could they work with you to really vet out their signature talk and ensure that it is connecting with both head and heart?
Another great question. So I work with people in a few different ways, both a little bit individually, but more often than not in groups, depending on what somebody's purpose is with speaking. And for anybody who's listening, who's just curious and continuing the conversation, there's two key ways to be able to do it. So for anyone who is on the consultant side, I encourage you to go to Nine Mistakes, and it's the word nine, N-I-N-E, mistakes.com. And I've got a free digital guide that shows nine mistakes that coaches, consultants, and experts make as speakers and how to avoid them. And for those who are perhaps thinking, I'm not sure if I want to be a quote speaker, but I want to be a better communicator in my business, or I want to be able to call people to take action on my ideas, I've got a cheat sheet called the Persuasive Communication Cheat Sheet that gives you lots of quick tips as a reference. And you can connect with me on LinkedIn, and just send me a message that says, can you send me the cheat sheet? And I'm happy to do that.
That's great. And how long do you think it usually takes somebody to polish, just to give people a sense if they wanted to start today? Because I like to make sure that we always leave these episodes with that one tip that they can put in action today, because we know action creates momentum and that's how you get forward. What would be something they do today to get started on developing that keynote topic?
I'm actually going to shift my answer a little bit because I think the most immediate next step for most is not always creating the topic, but it's telling somebody, I'm ready for a speaking opportunity even before you are. And I say that because most people can spend years unnecessarily polishing the topic before ever going out and saying, I'm ready to speak. But the truth is, you don't have to have a signature talk or a signature anything created to get that podcast interview, to get that opportunity to speak at a virtual conference. Get the opportunity first, and then go back and create the content, because now that why it's that booking that you have to be ready for.
That's beautiful. Well, Alexia Vernon, it was a pleasure to speak with you. I could talk to you for another 7 hours, but I
Me
think
too.
this is great for today. I think everybody should go and visit alexiavernon.com to get more information and to look at booking her as a speaker or hiring her as a consultant. As always, we are here at Momentum Magnet to give you actionable tips to put together in your life and business so that you can take action and see more growth. Today, it's about finding your core message, landing on that one idea that you bring to life. And perhaps today, your next action step is reaching out to your network to say you're ready as a speaker. Thank you for listening. We love hearing from you. We would love for you to go to iHeartRadio, iTunes, Pandora, or Spotify and leave a review. They matter and it helps us find our next guests. As always, feel free to visit us at momentummagnet.com and send us a message if you would like to join us for a future show. Thank you for listening. Have a great day and remember to take action.
Thank you for listening to Momentum Magnet. We're here every Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time to share inspiring comeback stories. We want to hear your reviews and love getting your subscriptions on iTunes and Spotify. For show notes and past episodes, visit momentummagnet.com. I'm Karen Morales, keynote speaker, writer, and founder and CEO of Marketing Magnet, a fast-growing marketing agency for purpose-driven companies. Whether you are a business needing an agency, or if you are looking for weekly tips to get ahead, sign up at marketing-magnet.com to receive our weekly inspiration on getting more in your life and business.